To start things off today, let me introduce you to Susanna Barlow. Susanna is from a large family. Well, that's an understatement. By large family, you think of, oh, who, the Octomom with her eight new babies and her six other kids, 14 children in the family. That's a lot. Maybe you think of John and Kate plus eight. Oh, that's a large family. Yeah, think of them. Susanna's family was a little bit larger. She was from a family of 46 children. And she's right in the middle at number 23. She grew up in a Mormon fundamentalist religious home where polygamy was practiced in all of its good and bad. She wrote about this experience in a memoir called What Peace There May Be. And I've invited her on here today because I always enjoy talking to people who've had first-person experiences that I have no idea about, and we can investigate it a little bit together here on the Big 550 KTRS. Hi, Susanna. How are you?
Hi, Paul.
Was I right with the numbers there? 23rd
right.
Or 46?
That's right.
How many moms?
Six.
Six moms, one dad.
That's right.
How does that work? What kind of home do 46 children, six mothers, and one father live in?
Well, it has to be very organized, very structured. We rose at between 5 and 6 a.m., everybody from the smallest child to the oldest adult.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, everything had to be very organized for it to run smoothly at all.
Now, of course, if you have 46 children and they were to come from one woman, she, of course, would have to be very old when the last one was born. But when it comes from six women, what's the age spread? How many years between the oldest and the youngest?
Well, my oldest brother is 55, and my youngest brother is 6.
So 49 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's still a pretty big spread.
Yes.
Yeah. You lived in Utah. You still live in Utah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about growing up in that home, particularly the bad part of it, which you write about brilliantly in the book. There was a lot of abuse in that house, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. And I like to make clear to people, because polygamy has a stigma of causing abuse, and it's very common, I believe. But I don't believe that it was the cause of the abuse in my family. It merely facilitated an abusive person. So it was a challenge, and part of the challenge was the isolation, that there was nowhere to go, there was no outside contact. It was almost like a world within a world.
Now, what do you mean there was no outside contact? Did you go to school?
No. No, there was no outside contact, period. I didn't go to a grocery store till I was about 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't leave the home for hardly any reason.
How did the kid, how were the kids able to not go to school? How does that work? Was everybody homeschooled by their older brothers and sisters?
Yeah, we were homeschooled by one of my father's wives.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there was no way to track us because none of us had authentic birth certificates.
Because you weren't born in hospitals?
We weren't born in hospitals. That's right. The polygamous communities tend to be very anti-medical establishment of any kind, only for absolute dire emergencies. And so there was just really no interaction with anyone.
When you talk about the stigma of abuse, and you don't think it's prevalent in necessarily goes connected with polygamy, it happened to because of the kind of person your father was. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was actually one of his wives that was the abuser.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And how did that... Was it mental abuse and physical abuse?
Yes, it was every kind you can imagine from her anyway. A lot of psychological abuse in addition to like starvation, isolation, all that kind of thing.
Isolation meaning go to your room and don't come out until I tell you to, and hours or maybe days would go by?
Yes, meaning being locked up in rooms for several days at a time, without food or water or anything like that. That kind of abuse, as well as physical beatings and, you know, constant humiliation, put downs, psychological abuse.
All from one of the women.
Uh huh.
Was she your biological mother?
No.
How did your actual biological mother and the other four women put up with that and allow a child to be treated that way?
Well, they all looked the other way, is what it came down to.
Were other kids abused by this woman also?
Yes. Oh, yes. There was a certain number of us that turned out to be her. I don't know, we just didn't get along very well, and we became the whipping boys of the family.
Literally.
In a lot of ways. Mm-hmm.
And the others would just ignore it?
Well, I think that my mother in particular, she knew subconsciously that it was going on, and when she saw it starting to happen, she would just leave. She would just literally exit the room, the vicinity. And I think it helped her remain in a state of denial about the severity of what was happening. In her mind, we were getting just corporal discipline.
Mm-hmm. So she would see you being beaten by this other wife, and she would leave the room so that she didn't have to experience the pain of watching you while you experienced the pain of being beaten.
That's right. And I think that she believed that she didn't have any power to change it. I don't think she liked it, but she needed to stay in a state of denial so that, because she felt totally powerless.
I guess when you're one of six wives in a polygamous relationship, you're denying a lot of stuff, aren't you?
You're denying everything.
Susanna, let me take a break, and we'll come back and talk some more. The book is called What Peace There May Be by Susanna Barlow. I'm Paul Harris for John Brown on the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris filling in for John Brown, talking with Susanna Barlow. She's written a memoir about her life in a polygamous sect made up of a father and six mothers. The book is called What Peace There May Be. It was a year ago that we heard a lot about polygamy in the news, in August of 2008, about a polygamist ranch run by a leader by the name of Warren Jeffs that included 534 women, 401 children, many of whom were deemed to be in danger. What was your relationship to these people, Susanna?
Well, the sects often splinter from one another. And in 1983, when I was 10 years old, the sect that I was raised in splintered off from a main body.
Mm-hmm.
And that main body included Warren Jeffs and his followers. And so my contact with them was severed around that time period.
And you never had any relationship with them later on?
No. I have siblings that have married into it that were married prior to that separation. And so there, I do have a couple of sisters that are currently in that sect right now.
Were they caught up in this story last year?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, in fact, when I watched the news, I could tell you who every single person was and what their relationship was, and, you know, to me through extended family relations.
Well, that's amazing.
So I knew them, but I didn't know them personally.
That's amazing to me because I have a small family. Of course, compared to you guys, everybody has a small family, but,
yeah,
you know, it's just me and my brother and a few cousins, and I have trouble keeping track of that. How do you keep track of 46 children in a family? I asked you at the beginning, did you all live in one house? But I'm guessing it was more of a sprawling compound, wasn't it?
No, it was a very small house. I mean, small considering the size of family we had.
Well, how many bedrooms do you need for 46 kids, six women, and a father?
Well, not everybody had their own bedroom. Once you hit a certain age, you usually slept on a couch or in a sleeping bag on the floor. There just wasn't the accommodations for that many people. So each mother had her own separate bedroom, and kids were just bunked three and four deep in the basement or bedrooms, wherever they could be.
So there might be a double bed or a queen-size bed in there, and several kids are sleeping in it every night.
Yeah, essentially. Well, we often did, like, triple bunk beds that had three beds in one upright structure, and we just load in onto those.
Your book is kind of a coming-of-age story, but it also tells how you decided to contact the outside world and tell the story to a newspaper journalist. Would you share that with my audience?
Well, I had reached a point around the age of 14 where I had become quite desperate. And I had seen a couple siblings had run away from home out of the same desperation, the abuse and the control and all of that. And they ended up being in terrible situations. One brother got into drugs and was living homeless on the streets, and he was 14 years old. And I saw this, and I realized that my option of running away was just not possible. I didn't want to be in their situation. I didn't want to get caught into a drug situation or be homeless. So I, as much as I disliked my situation at home, I didn't feel like I had very many options. Well, in one day, I saw this article written by a newspaper fellow that had a column, and I just got this harebrained idea to contact him. And I wasn't contacting him to ask him to rescue me or anything. It was more like I wanted a connection with another human being because I had lost it with my family. Mm-hmm. I had been isolated and abused for so long that I didn't feel like I belonged to anyone anywhere. And so my reaching out to him was out of a need for love, even if it was just from one human being to another. And I developed a tentative relationship with him, but I was terrified to tell him my background because I was raised and taught that if the outside world finds out about the way that we lived, that they would hate you and that you would be spurned. And we were, you know, that was proved true to me when we did go outside the home. We were often spit on by teenage boys coming home from the high school that was up the street. So I had a lot of confirmation that that outside world was a very scary, dangerous place. And I was hated for looking so different and being so different and having a different lifestyle.
How did you look so different?
Well,
how could they tell you by just looking at you?
Well, growing up, you know, we had to wear long sleeves that went down to the wrists, and girls weren't allowed to cut their hair at all. We weren't allowed to wear pants. All the girls had to wear, you know, skirts or dresses. And you weren't supposed to have skin showing, so you couldn't go bare-legged or no bare feet, no sandals, nothing like that. Well, they called it modest, but it's a bit extreme mm-hmm. when it comes to modesty. There was a lot of covering up of your body, and there was an emphasis put on being somewhat ugly. You didn't want to be pretty. You didn't want to accentuate or highlight your appearance. You wanted to downplay it. And so I did. I felt very ugly, and I knew how I appeared to other people when I walked out that front gate. And, you know, I'd get the stares and people laughing at you or, you know, whatnot. It was always kids. It was never grown-ups. I never had a real negative experience other than just the silent staring. And as a kid, it's hard to take.
Susanna Barlow's book is called What Peace There May Be. We'll take another break and come back and talk some more. I'm Paul Harris. This is the John Brown Show on the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Susanna Barlow. 23rd child in her family. That puts her right in the middle of the pack of 46 children. They now range in age from the youngest at 6 to the oldest. Well, I don't think you'd call a 55-year-old a child anymore. Somebody's child, of course. Well, in this case, we had one man and 6 women who were the adults, the parents in this situation. It was an abusive situation for Susanna, and she writes about that in her memoir, which is called What Peace There May Be, which is a rather remarkable expose of her life inside this polygamous sect in Utah. You talked in the last segment, Susanna, about feeling the need to go to somebody on the outside to have a relationship of some kind with someone on the outside, and so you contacted a newspaper columnist. What happened after that?
Well, I kept my true identity a secret from him. Whether or not he knew and never said anything, I don't know. And so I consulted him mostly on how I was feeling and how do I cope with this and that and the other. And he was very, very patient. I look back on it now and I just shake my head in surprise and awe that someone, an adult, would take the time to just continue to talk to this young kid. And he didn't realize the scope of the abuse and the trauma and that I was going through. I felt so terrified of exposing that. And I developed a relationship that became a kind of anchor for my life, because I was bordering suicidal, and having him there to turn to over and over again became a source of strength for me and a reason not to end my life.
How soon did he start writing about the stories you were telling him about your life?
He didn't.
Never wrote about them. Newspaper columnist never decided that this was a topic for publication.
Well, like I said, I kept most of it totally a secret from him. And most of the times I talked to him 5 or 10 minutes. But it was just a chance to know that there was somebody out there, somebody knew my name, somebody knew I existed. I was flesh and bone. I mattered somehow, some way.
And you had to keep that outside contact secret, right? You couldn't let anybody in the house know.
Oh, yeah, no, I couldn't. I told a couple of siblings about it, and we thrilled about it in private. But, you know, of how naughty I was for doing it, but none of them realized the degree of desperation that I had reached either. And so when I confronted the issue of suicide with him and told him how I really felt that I had wanted to kill myself, he really stepped up and supported me not doing that, and told me to call him whenever I felt like I was getting desperate. And he, in a lot of ways, I wonder if he didn't prevent me from going further eventually down that path and ending my life.
Did he encourage you to get out?
No, because he didn't have any idea. He didn't have any idea. As far as he was concerned, I was just a kid struggling at home with my own feelings. You know, I lied to him. I told him that I went to a private school. Didn't give him too many details, and just made him believe that I was just some ordinary kid.
So how did you get out?
I didn't do that until I had my first child. After I was married, I was married to a man that grew up in the same sect as I did, and I was, you know, we were both single. And when I had that first child, I just was struck with the enormity of the responsibility. And what was I going to give this child? What kind of life was I going to now provide for this new person whose whole existence was dependent upon me? And that's when I really began to question what I was doing there, what I believed, and my commitment to that at all.
When you say you married a man who was part of the same sect, does that mean he was your brother?
No, it just means that he was in the same group. There was a small group of people in Salt Lake, and we didn't live in a compound. Everyone lived in separate homes spread out across the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we would meet about every 2 weeks and have what would be considered a church service. And so I wasn't allowed to talk to him or anything of that nature, but we saw one another. All of us, you know, you'd see all the other available males in the room, and they were all scanning the room for all the available females.
And was he also from a large family, also fundamentalist Mormons?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so you two finally hooked up and got married. and had your own kid and decided that the fundamentalist Mormon beliefs that you had grown up exposed to all of those years were not for you anymore?
Yes, that's right.
So yeah. you don't live in a polygamous sect anymore?
No.
But you know plenty of people who do?
Oh, yes.
Did you, once you came to the conclusion that the life that you had been part of was wrong, did you decide it was wrong or just that you didn't want any part of it anymore?
Well, it took a while to separate, you know, the abuse and all of that.
Yeah.
And be able to identify that the practice of polygamy itself was not necessarily the cause of the abuse. And so that took some time, but I knew that the control and all of that, it was just a violation of human rights.
And so did you then encourage some of your brothers and sisters that they had to get out?
No, I didn't. And part of the reason for that is because nobody could have convinced me to leave when I was there. Nobody.
At any age?
At any of those ages, they couldn't have convinced me to leave. I'm leaving my family. I'm leaving my whole entire world and everything I've ever known and the security of that.
Mm-hmm.
Each person must come to that decision on their own. And I knew that any kind of attempts that I made to try to get any of the other siblings to leave would be foiled. They didn't. Many of them have left, consequently,
mm-hmm.
but of their own will. And I didn't want to violate their freedom any more than I wanted mine violated.
Susanna, the Mormon Church does not embrace polygamy anymore, hasn't for quite a while, but it still has an enormous amount of power in the state of Utah. And the state of Utah and the United States of America have laws against polygamy.
That's true.
So how does a polygamous sect continue to exist? We know about the one last year that got in trouble with the hundreds of wives and the hundreds of children and the abuse that was going on there. Why is law enforcement not doing more about groups like the one that you grew up in?
Well, partly because they're kept very secretive, and they don't have a great big gigantic compound that you can see from the air. And it's very difficult to pin them down and discover where they're existing.
But there have been so many people who have gotten out of there, like you, who realized that what they were growing up in the midst of was not proper.
Mm-hmm.
Why has more not been done about that to stop the abuse? You were certainly not alone, and you said at the beginning that you don't want polygamy to have the stigma of being attached to child abuse, and I believe you when you say that, but you were certainly not alone in that, and we learned from the 401 children who were in the Jeffs sect, who were all brought out last year, that there was a lot of abuse going on there. So why do we not have the authority saying, if there's this much abuse going on in these sort of family situations, we need to do more to look into that?
Well, I obviously am not in law enforcement, and I couldn't, you know, answer that question to my satisfaction. It's something that I've often wondered about myself. I know that it's difficult to prosecute because the law states that polygamy is considered unlawful cohabitation. And that covers a pretty broad range of relationships. And so I know that there's been a problem there. And they have actually, at least here in Utah, the Attorney General has approached dealing with polygamy from a sexual abuse and physical abuse position.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, you need people to testify. You need people who are in it to come forward. When I was in it, dealing with it, I would not have testified against my family. No matter how bad it was, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
This must have been an incredibly strict home.
It was.
And when I hear about the stories like yours, and I read the details of your story in your book, you know, for a long time my attitude about polygamy was, look, I don't care what consenting adults do. We got plenty of places where you got two women living with a man or two men living with a woman or you know, any multiple, mm-hmm. any combination. It goes on. None of that's my business. I don't really think it's anybody else's business. But when we get down to child abuse, I think there's a line that's crossed. You experienced the crossing of that line, and you no doubt witnessed it amongst other children in that house, and that's where I feel that I wish more were being done by authority figures who, when they hear any inkling of a story like yours, say, okay, you know what, this is something we need to look into to stop. Not to stop the adults from doing whatever they want in a consenting way with each other, but to stop 13-year-old girls like you were from thinking, you know what, killing myself may be a good out.
Right. I agree with you 100%. I couldn't be more on board with that sentiment. I feel very strongly that the abuse that went on needed to stop then, and I didn't know quite how to go about accomplishing that.
Yeah.
Even as a kid, and it was the only thing I knew, I was abused from the time I was old enough to remember anything. I knew somewhere inside that what was happening was wrong, and it was a violation against me. I just never realized the depth of that violation or the degree of it until I had my own child and realized that another person physically harmed me. And if my mother felt the way I felt toward my little child, it was just something I couldn't even fathom at that point.
Is your life now one woman, one man, one child?
Absolutely. Well, more than one child, but it's definitely one man and one woman, and will remain so.
Susanna, I really appreciate you coming on to talk about your story. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Susanna Barlow's book is What Peace There May Be. I'm Paul Harris. This is the John Brown Show on the Big 550 KTRS.